Okay, so this talk is going to be very, very different from everything you've heard today. And actually, this is my first talk in front of the largely physicist audience. So all sorts of feedback is welcome at the end. So if 20 minutes from now you have no idea why I'm doing this and what I'm doing, you know, let me know. So, my name is Anya Taflilovich. I'm just finishing up my PhD right here at the University of Toronto. And I'm going to talk to you about predicative, as in predicate, predicative quantum programming. And the first thing I want to ask you to do is to take a step back. So why are you all guys here? What are we doing? Well, we're somewhere along the line. We want to have a quantum computer, and we want to write programs for it. I know almost nothing about building a quantum computer, so I'm going to talk to you about writing programs for it. And as far as writing programs goes, computer scientists as a community have quite a bit of experience with it. So stuff goes wrong, stuff happens, and ad hoc programming really does not work, and we have a lot of experience with this. We really need more of a systematic approach to software and hardware development, and there's an area called formal verification or formal methods of software design or logic of programming, mathematics of programming. It's known under many different names, and it's concerned precisely with the task of providing tools, providing a framework for building verifiably correct programs, for developing verifiably correct algorithms, protocols, etc. And this is precisely what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to present a good framework that will allow us to prove quantum programs correct. So proving them correct, meaning like machine verifiably correct. And the basis for this work is something that's called the refinement calculus. Now, what is that? That's the way of building programs that goes as follows. You start with a specification that is a rigorous description of what it is that you want. And you end, the end product is a program that is a rigorous description of how to do it. The program is something you can run in a computer right away. And you move step by step from from the specification to the program in such a way that every step you make is justified by a law or an axiom or theorem, something. And thus it can be verified by a machine, such as a theorem prover or another kind of a prover. And of course, as a result, you end up with the correct program because you were never allowed to introduce a mistake as you went sort of step by step along in this process. And what's also nice is it turns out you can build into this machinery some, although rather limited, time and space complexity analysis and also probabilistic analysis. So what did I do for my PhD? What am I still doing? I've created a unified framework for writing specifications, developing programs, performing complexity, probabilistic and security analysis for, and this is important, I wanted to work for both classical and quantum algorithms. I wanted to be like a sound extension. Classical and quantum algorithms, classical and quantum distributed systems, communication, and cryptographic protocols. Okay, this didn't come out of nowhere. So predicative programming has been known in the community for many years. That's been developed by my advisor many years ago, and it's been rather recently extended to include probabilistic programs, and my work was to extend that to quantum programs. Okay, and here's one slide on predicative programming. So suppose you're given a specification F. This says, if my variable X starts out to be non-negative, then after the computation is complete, I want it to be zero. That's all it says. Notice that we use unprimed variables, such as this X here, to stand for initial values, that is, value of a variable before a computation starts, and prime variables for final values or post values, that is, the values of variables after the computation is complete. And this specification here, is the in the simplest form, is simply a Boolean expression. And we say that specification S is refined by or is implemented by P if the relationship between them is simply a logical implication. Now, how do I read this line? Well, it's actually a program. This is something you can run on a computer right away. What does it do? Well, it examines the current value of x. If it's zero, it does nothing. Okay, means it does nothing. Otherwise, you decrement x and repeat. This is sequential composition, and the fact that s occurs here on the left and on the left and on the right means it's a loop or recursive call, right? So that's one way to read this line. It's a program. Another way to read this line is, well, this is a logical expression. It's something that's either true or false. It's an implication. So you can prove it. So how do you prove it? Well, you start with the right side. You apply a certain step here. So for example, here, what did they do? Well, I expanded the definition of x. I expanded. Okay, notice that this is purely syntactic. Like, you can give it to a computer. It's going to say, yeah, you can do it, or no, you can't. Then you apply some other law. So the stuff here in the yellow box is something that is like a set of axioms in your theorem prover, something it can has access to. Then I'm extending the meaning of if then else, etc., etc. Now, sometimes it's possible for the computer to do this whole thing by itself, like in a simple case. Otherwise, it needs some guidance, because in general it's undecidable. But in any case, it's machine verifiable. So most of the times, it's not going to do the thing for you, but it's going to verify that what you're doing is okay, which is kind of nice in itself. So that's predicated programming. Well, that has been extended to include probabilistic programs, and I've extended it further to include quantum programs. That means I need to specify certain things that you can do. Like, first of all, what am I manipulating? Well, I'm manipulating these quantum states that's just like a qubit register, like a 2 to the n bit thing of complex numbers. And I'm using something I call a Dirac-like notation in the faint hope that somewhere along the way physicists will find it at least vaguely familiar and easy to work with. But the underlying semantics here is this is just a function. I need to specify what are the operations that I'm allowed. Yeah. I hope. Yep. That's a function. This is how you usually specify a function. So this is a function of parameter I from the domain. This is a bunch of things from 0 to 2 to the n, and it's 0 everywhere and 1 in the location I. So it's your, you know, one of the computational bases. It's the long thing, 0 everywhere and I, 1 in one spot.
Okay, so the next one, 0 number I.
Yeah. So this is 2 to the 1, right? So 0, 1. This is 1 if and only if I is 0 and 0 otherwise. Right? So this is a 1, 0. Okay? And here, you do pointwise function composition. Right? And this is the usual tensor. I'm just saying that this is a shortcut for doing this. Okay? This is exactly what you expect it to be. Okay. So I specify things that you are allowed to do. Well, you're allowed to initialize stuff to zero. You're allowed to apply unitary transformations. You're allowed to measure. Now, this is going to get a little big, but it's okay. Still, it's specifiable, and you know, it's specifiable to a machine. It's verifiable. Whenever you use this rule, it's verifiable. Now, so this is a distribution. This basically says that after you perform a measurement, you have a particular distribution of this thing and this thing, and the rest of the stuff is not affected by the computation. But this is the measurement and the computational basis, the easiest one, and there's the general one. You also need to specify, to be able to reason about a distributed system, you need to specify what it means to perform things in parallel, so you need to specify the meaning of the parallel composition. So if P and Q are two different quantum processes, well, what does it mean to perform them in parallel? And this is what you'd expect. So if these are two unitaries, so here you partition P owns the first n qubits, and you look surprised, and Q owns the latter one, then what does it mean for the two things to run in parallel under with this sort of shared thing? And similarly for measurement. And you need to say what a quantum channel is. Yes? What do you mean, how is this parallel? I'm just defining what it means to be parallel. So if I have one qubit and you have one qubit, right, I do something on my own and you do something on your own, but, you know, we are, so this phi here is like a global thing, right? But you own part of it and I own part of it. So if you apply U sub P and I apply U sub Q, what are we both doing? We're applying the tensor, right? So it's just that, you know, you need to specify who is responsible for what things. Like, so if P can only access the first N and Q can only access the second N, you still need to be able to write something like this in parallel. Right? And there needs to be a symmetric. What did it do to the entire system? And in order to reason about communication protocols, like in a classical case, you have a classical communication channel, so you need a quantum communication channel. And it's not important what exactly these are. It's basically a tuple of all these things. Right? What's important is, so this notation says output psi on a channel Q. And I use the word channel very differently from what you guys did all day today. So this is channel, as I mean, I'm sending something on a channel to somebody else, like as if, you know, a qubit is traveling along the way. So this says output psi on quantum channel Q. And what's important to notice is that this is just a logical expression again. Right? This is just Boolean. And similarly for read, this is just Boolean. And there's a small technical typo here. This is supposed to be in quotes, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so what can you do once you've defined? Yes. Okay. So this is send, and this is receive. These are pretty standard notation. So the exclamation point is sending this qubit on this channel, and receiving is receiving the qubit from a channel. And you only, so in this setting, you're only able to define one-way channels, but that's okay because a two-way channel is just two one-way channels. So what can you do with this? Well, you can analyze all sorts of things, right? So you can analyze something that's simple, like a Deutsch's problem, right? Well, you need to specify what do I want it to compute. Well, I'm saying, okay, I have a variable x, and I want the final value of x to be the value of f of 0 x or f of 1, right? And also, so t is a time variable. It's like a global variable that each particular party is not able to modify, right? It's like a time tick. And this ticks every time a quantum oracle is called, right? So this says you're only allowed to query a quantum oracle once. So this is the use of f. You're only allowed to query it once. Okay, I can write a program. Now, this thing I can presumably someday execute on a quantum computer because it's built up, you know, from the primitives that I specified earlier. So, you know, you initialize to zero, you apply Hadamard, you query an oracle, apply again, and you measure into this variable x, And no subscript here means computational basis. Okay, so what can I prove? Well, I can prove that, in fact, P implies S. So P correctly implements the specification S. And it's this part here that's machine verifiable. So, of course, there's work, sort of human brain work, that's done into specifying these things correctly. But the hope is that, you know, just specifying it is not as tricky as proving something correct. Right? So, yeah, somebody like a human being would need to come up with a specification and we need to come up with a program. But this part here is at least can be offloaded to the computer. You were like, yeah. Okay, machine verifiable means on a classical computer, it's machine verifiable.
So basically, we have a computer given the rules.
Yeah.
Give it the code and then make the
code. More or less. Like, you need to guide it along the way in this process, but at every step, it's going to say, yeah, okay, oh no, you made a mistake. And then you have to figure out where you made a mistake. It's not very good at pointing out where. Yeah. Yeah, undecidable. It's not about complexity. It's in general impossible to do it. That's why I'm saying you need to guide it along the way. Like, each step is fine, but if you wanted to produce the whole thing, it's not going to. You need to guide it along the way. It's like with any theorem prover. Right? Yeah. Good point. Okay. So that was very simple, but, you know, we've also analyzed other stuff like Tojo's or Grover's and Shor's and stuff. Okay. Then I looked at pseudo-telepathy games. Now, why them? Because this is like distributed computing with no communication between them. So there are no channels, but there's entanglement between parties. And how many of you are familiar with pseudo-telepathy games? Yeah. So these are like contrived tasks. So you have N players. And for each player, you specify where the inputs come from. You specify the domain of the inputs. You specify the range of outputs of the player. You usually have a promise on the so some condition that you know holds on the inputs. You specify the winning condition. That's usually a relationship between inputs and outputs. And the strategy is, in our setting, is a program. So you have to get it down to the executable. And these are usually contrived so that there is no way for the classical players to meet the condition with high probability, but for quantum players, you can. Yes. Yeah. There's a class of them. And so this is how you formally specify what it means for the strategy to be winning. Now, what this says, this is unfortunate, this exclamation point is no longer output in the channel. It's like a learn operator. And it's defined formally here. The intuition is, okay, so this strategy S, this program that the players are implementing, given that the promise holds, this will entail this normalized form of the winning condition. And you need to have it formalized because you're now dealing with probabilities. And if it's not normalized, then this less than equal to is meaningless. But basically, this says that this strategy, given that the promise holds, entails the winning condition, like the normalized form of the winning condition. So for example, you can look at the Merman's game is just a simple one-round thing. You have three players. They get inputs that are just bits, and they must produce outputs that are bits. And this is the promise. The promise is that the parity of these is zero. And they must come up with these y0, y1, y2 so that the XOR of the final values is the sum of the inputs over 2. And, you know, you can show that this is hard for... So they can talk to each other before the experiment begins, but while they're doing this, there's no communication going on. Right? And you can show that for any strategies that they come up with beforehand, you know, classically they will not be able to succeed with larger than, I think it's 75% or something chance, but quantumly they will succeed with probability 1, and this is what you can show here. So here the program is, well, you start with a state, and you execute these three in parallel with this psi, with them sharing psi. And each program says, well, I look at the input. If it's 1, I apply this unitary. If not, I don't. Then apply Hadamard and measure into this output variable y. And again, you can show that this relationship actually holds. Right? So this part here is machine verifiable. And we've analyzed more, such as the Jose game and the parity games, which is an extension of the Merman to N players. Okay, so far so good. We are now dealing with distributed systems, but so far there's been no communication between them. So now let's introduce some communication, but now we're introducing just a classical channel of communication between them. And we're going to do quantum teleportation. So you have Alice and Bob. Alice wants to teleport Psi to Bob. She has two classical bits, A and B, and they share the entangled state phi. And so she can't send this, so she sends B and A on a channel, and at the end, Bob is able to reconstruct this. So that's your teleportation. And, you know, if you look at Nielsen and Chang or something, they will usually have one diagram like this, which is rigorous in the sense that, you know, given a good language, you can feed this to a computer to verify. But this is not it. This doesn't show any channels. This doesn't show any communication. So to show communication, you usually have something in the bullet form, and this is not something you can feed to a computer. So we specify teleportation formally as follows. Well, you need to specify the partitioning of the variables before everything happens. So the 0 qubit is the one she wants to teleport. This 1 and 2 are in the maximally entangled state here. And so this is the state before we start computing, and we want to say that after we're finished, we want Bob's qubit to be in the state in which, you know, Alice's qubit was, it's the general one. And more importantly, but also important, is that we have spent two classical bits of communication and no quantum bits. Right. So So, and you have to build this in, because otherwise you can implement the specification by just sending something on a quantum channel, but that's not teleportation. So you have to specify that, you know, this stays the same, like this counter stays the same. And this is built in into the definition of channel. So again, each party will have no way of sort of tricking this number. And here's the formal program. Well, you have, this is a declaration of a local classical channel, CH, that's a local, it's a type bit. And you execute process Alice and process Bob in parallel with an appropriate partition of variables. So Alice performs some local operations on her stuff, measures and sends the results of measurement, sends the first one, the second one to Bob. What does Bob do? He reads from a channel, records that into his variable B0, reads from a channel, records that into his variable B1, and performs the local operations at the end. Right? And you can show that this relationship actually holds. And this less than or equal to is here instead of the logical implication, again, because we're dealing with probabilities, and an S doesn't mention all of the variables. Right? So it's going to be less than or equal to. So this part here is going to be machine verifiable. Okay, so far we have distributed computation, we have a classical channel between them, so let's introduce a quantum channel between them. And as an example, we're going to look at the quantum dense coding. So here, you know, the task is the opposite. You have a quantum channel, she wants to send A and B to Bob. Instead, she sends a qubit, and at the end, he knows the values of these bits. This time, Nielsen in China is not going to draw anything because there's nothing really to draw. And there's, again, going to be this bullet form thing that is difficult to give to a computer. So, again, you have a specification. So you start with the partitioning of variables to know, you know, that Alice only has access to these variables and Bob only has access to these ones. And you must have this maximum entangled state between the two. And the requirement is that at the end, the final values of Bob's bits, so B0 prime, BY prime, is the same as the initial values of Alice's bits, A0, A1. And there's, again, restriction on the counter. So no classical bits have been sent on the channel, and one quantum bit has been sent on the quantum channel. Okay. And we have this parallel program that implements the specification S. So the program has now a local quantum channel. It executes two processes in parallel with an appropriate partitioning of variables. So Alice examines her bits, does something to the qubit depending on the values of these bits, right, and sends it on the channel. What does Bob do? Well, he reads from the channel, he does stuff to the qubit, and he measures. Okay, and again, you can prove that P is less than or equal to S. And this part here is machine verified. Okay. More complicated stuff. So this is what I'm doing now, is the formalizing and analyzing this cryptographic protocol. So this gets very messy very fast, but it's still doable. So you now, so I'm looking at BB84, the quantum key distribution protocol. So you have one quantum channel, and so this goes from Alice to Bob, and you have a classical channel that's both ways, but it has to be formalized as two classical channels, one going from Alice to Bob and one from Bob to Alice. So Alice chooses two bits at random. She sets the value of a qubit that will depend on these two bits. She sends the qubit to Bob. Bob picks a random basis and measures this qubit in this basis into this result variable. Okay, so why is the measurement result? Why did we do this? Oh, no, sorry. So this is the first round of the protocol, which is where quantum communication happens, and the second round is where the classical, so they exchange these A and B, they exchange bases, they announce them on the channel. So A, Alice says, sends A on B, and Bob sends B to A. So at the end, these are the variables that Alice has access to, these are the variables that Bob has access to. And of course, what you want is you want to show that if the bases coincide, then they share this common bit. So X prime is Y prime, so that's your shared key. And more importantly, why did we do this? It's because if there is Eve, who is tapping into these channels at the end, she still has no clue. Right? That was the general idea. So what do you do? Well, again, you specify this as a program. Now you have one quantum channel, two classical channels. You execute process Alice and process B in parallel. with the appropriate partitioning of variables. And this is the specification of what Alice does. Well, she chooses X and A at random. She does some local stuff. She sends a qubit on the quantum channel, sends bit A on a classical channel, reads, that's what Bob is sending her, reads something from Bob, and records it into this variable S of A. It records whether the round was successful. So they need this bit of information at the end to know if whatever they did is was meaningful. And they should keep the, if Alice should keep X and Bob should keep Y. And Bob selects a basis at random, reads from a channel, so this is he's reading from Alice, from the quantum channel that Alice has sent, reads from the classical channel, measures qubit in basis B into result Y, then sees if the basis actually matched and sends this information back to Alice. So again, analyzing this in parallel with this is long, but it's not undoable. It's still machine check. It's long, but there's nothing difficult about it once you formalize all this. And what are we proving? Well, we're proving this pair of things. Why do we need two? Well, because we need these things from Alice's perspective and from Bob's perspective. So Alice needs to know that this program that she's been executing with Bob, given that S sub A is one, so she has the information, she has S sub A only. So given that she thinks the round is successful, this entails that they share a common key. And similarly, from Bob's perspective, he needs to know that if he thinks that the round was successful, they also share a common key. And this pair is what is machine verifiable. So again, there's a bit of work done into writing this, but this part can be machine checkable, although it's rather long. Okay, and we've looked at more protocols, like the N rounds of BB84. This gets even messier, but again, it's not anything that's undoable. It's not difficult. The BB92, and this is in general what I'm doing now. Okay, so in summary, what did I set up to do? Well, I was going to provide the unifying framework for writing specifications, developing programs, performing complexity, probabilistic, and security analysis for all of these things. You want classical and quantum algorithms, distributed systems, communication, and cryptographic protocols. The stuff that's highlighted in blue has been done. The stuff that's also highlighted in dark blue, I guess, is what I'm doing now. It's almost done, except for the performing security analysis. Right, so the whole point of doing this BB84 was that, you know, if you can model Eve, you can say that at the end of the computation, she has no knowledge. And I'm currently struggling with this. There are very few methods in the formal verification community for analyzing anything to do with classical cryptography either, so it's not a big drawback on my part. But this is challenging, and this is going to be fun. Thank you.